students begin a new school year, Philosophical Currents examines a deceptively simple question. A new year is underway, brings new teachers, new subjects, and new opportunities to learn, but beneath the daily lessons and assignments lies a larger philosophical question. What does it actually mean to be educated? Is education primarily about acquiring knowledge, preparing for a career, or learning how to live a thoughtful and meaningful life? And can someone hold advanced degrees yet still lack wisdom? Here to explore these questions in our monthly Philosophical Currents segment is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein in his 26th year as professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, 26 years is a long time. Congratulations about that.
Yes, it is a really long time. And it's enhanced by the fact that I'm now older than I've ever been. And that's, you know, I'm not used to this, right?
Aren't we all younger? Well, welcome to Main Street and Philosophical Currents. And I want to begin with the central question of what we're going to talk about today. Jack, what does it mean to be educated?
This is such an interesting question because it is complex in all of the ways that you articulated. We have this distinction between knowledge and wisdom. We have this distinction between theory and practice, street smarts versus book smarts, and all of that sort of thing. But also, the very question betrays a radical shift that many of our listeners will have experienced in their lifetime. And that was the 1960s. Because before the 1960s in the United States, there was a general agreement about what it meant to be educated. You knew certain books, you understood certain history, you had a certain set of ethics, you looked towards certain heroes and role models, and you came through education, you came through institutions having a strong grasp of this common knowledge that other educated people could identify you by using and by seeing how you dressed and how you spoke and what you referenced. In the 1950s, when women were in college, the most populated major was, my students, I ask that question, they always say home economics, and I say no, because they learned how to cook at home. It was art history. And the reason why it was art history was that it allowed women to learn how to make small talk at parties and gatherings, because most women went to college for what was called an MRS degree. They were looking to get married. And if they weren't married or at least engaged by the end of their freshman year, they were considered old maids, spinsters. In the 1960s, all of that changed. And activists came along because of civil rights, because of gay rights, because of feminism, because of the Indian civil rights movements, and said, look, you have this closed, the term is canon, this collection of books that you're supposed to read. And some of them are fine, but why aren't there any people with the experience of a slave in them? Why aren't there women represented? Why aren't there gay voices represented? And is it only supposed to talk to the elite and the rich and the wealthy, right? Why is it all the Great Gatsby? And why is it not the story of the homeless kid in the Bronx? And the activists, especially on campus, but also around the whole culture, forced us to completely shift our understanding of what it meant to be a valid voice. Now, for a while, that took a very extreme position that people will know, where they're like, oh, you're a dead white man, we're not going to listen to you. But eventually it evened out to have an open canon to say, yes, Shakespeare is relevant and important, but so is Toni Morrison. And Thomas Jefferson is wonderful, but so is Booker T. Washington. And now we have a tremendous fragmentation of what it counts to be educated, because people will choose an education based not just on their career purposes, but on their cultural purposes or their social purposes. And so different people will be differently educated in different contexts, and they'll often be unable to speak to one another.
In the 60s that you talked about, is that when this saying surfaced, Jack? How to think, not what to think. Is that distinction as clear as it sounds? Is that what we learned, what I thought I learned in school, critical thinking, if you will? Is that when this came of age, so to speak?
That idea is actually first initiated in Plato. In the early Republic, in the early dialogues about 350 before the Common Era. And Plato tried to model what it meant to know something. And these are my words, what I'm about to say, not his. But for Plato, to know something is to be able to define and defend it. So if someone asks you, what is love? You have to be able to offer a definition of love, and then you have to defend the notion of love from its detractors. And he distinguished between what he called knowledge and what he called true belief. Knowledge is being able to define and defend, understand, explain, articulate. And true belief is knowing a fact or getting something right, even though you don't understand it. So if you ask me, is the starting quarterback of the University of North Dakota a good starting quarterback? And I said, sure, they always pick good guys. He's great. That may be a true belief, maybe a false belief, but it may be a true belief, but I don't understand why, I can't defend it, etc. And so from the earliest philosophical discussions, we had this distinction between knowing and understanding what something was versus just being able to recite it. Now, the way you got this was, again, another fancy word, dialectically. You had a conversation, and this is what Socrates in the dialogues model. You talk to someone, you ask questions, you show you don't know anything, and you engage critically with ideas for the sole purpose of finding out the truth and not winning the argument. This passed through lots of different notions of what knowledge was, different role of religion, different role of science and freedom. And then, for academic reasons that I can tell you if you're interested, in the 1970s, we started having this notion of critical thinking. And critical thinking is a phrase used, I mean, here's the short version of what I wasn't going to say. Departments had to be funded, and they were funded by how many students they would get. And English departments were always funded by freshman writing programs, right? All the students had to take writing programs. And so philosophy departments said, we're going to get in on this racket. We want to get as many students as possible. We want to teach, we want to require logic for all of the students, but logic was abstract and mathematical. So they invented this concept of critical thinking, which was used to designate thinking critically, thoughtfully, in a disciplined manner, unbiased about our everyday life, about our everyday judgments. And that became the way that the departments funded themselves, but it had a profound impact on the culture. And so in the 1960s, what people said was, there are many, many ways of thinking, and you can't judge one better than the other. And then there's a whole thread about this called, among other things, postmodernism. In the 1980s, what people started saying was, yes, there are many, many ways of thinking, but you can judge them by certain, a technical term is field variant, but by certain ideas that are in every arena of thought: objectivity, defensibility, relevance, right? Relevance is a really important, is something relevant? If I say to you, the quarterback is going to win because he is wearing his pink necklace today, you can say to me, that's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with it. And you say, and I say, but every time he won, he wore that pink necklace. And you say, that's a superstition. And you can call it a superstition because every field has a standard of relevance, even if what makes something relevant different. So critical thinking tries to describe the universal patterns of reasoning, of inference, of logic, of rationality that can be applied to all of the different ways of thinking.
Enjoy my conversation, as I do each month, with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein in this segment we call Philosophical Currents. We are talking about what it means to be educated. Jack, you said a word earlier, you said foundation. And so can we learn without first developing a strong shared foundation of knowledge? And I kind of take this thought back to earlier, as you pointed out, students were learning the same thing. We had the same foundation. And now I don't think that's true.
There's a bunch of ways I can take this, including a sort of deeply metaphysical response, which talks about the unity of the oneness of the universe, right? For philosophers who are listening, the problem of the one and the many, but we're not going to worry about that. Here's the thing. Many different people have many different styles of knowledge or styles of learning. And so some people can learn by, here is an abstraction, here is math, here is science, here are the things that you learn, now build on that. But other people have to come in through the back door, have to say, I know how, I will learn with my hands, and I know how to build an engine. I can rebuild a carburetor. And so someone can come along and say, okay, I'm going to teach you how government works. And the voter is like the gasoline, and the legislature is like the pistons, and, you know, do something like that, right? Create metaphors that allow us to build knowledge on what a person already understands. So I don't think that there is one standard way of building knowledge. This is also something that shifted. Again, so I've said this before on the show, but I'll say it again. The American education system gets a lot of flack, but it has successfully done something that no other education system has ever done in the history of the world, which is it has educated a mass population of profound difference, different economic classes, different ethnic backgrounds, different religions, different skill levels. It educates everybody. And sometimes it doesn't do an excellent job, but often it does a very, very good job. When the public education system was first initiated, its goal was to take immigrants and turn them into Americans, to assimilate everybody, to cleanse them of their non-Americanness. Again, from the 1960s on, this began to shift to affirm people's heritage and to try to teach in a way that overlaps their Americanness with a sense of respect of their heritage. And once you accept that, you accept that there are different methods of teaching that will apply to different people. So the last episode of Why Radio was, what is Jewish philosophy? And one of the biggest differences between Judaism and, let's say, mainstream Christianity is, in mainstream Christianity, doubting the scripture, doubting the clergy, challenging the beliefs is regarded as sinful and problematic and a violation of faith. In Judaism, everything is questioning. Everything is challenging, and you can be completely and utterly resistant to God's law, to what your rabbi says, as a form of learning and understanding about it. So you've got some traditions where learning is more about memorization and belief and trust. I had a student years ago who was raised evangelical, and really brilliant student. And we did like five classes together and a bunch of independent studies. And because he was raised in that context, he had the most amazing text memory. So we're doing a philosopher named Hume, and I'd say, oh, Hume says something about this, this, and this. And he would say, oh yeah, that's on page 79. Just unbelievable. And that's because he grew up in a system in which it was his job to reproduce the text and the belief, and every line is holy and to be understood as written. Whereas someone like me, you won't be surprised, is raised in a system in which I challenge everything. I'm skeptical of everything. I'm a big pain in the butt for everyone because that's how I learn. And so what a good education system needs and what a college can do better than a K through 12 is respond in multiple ways to multiple learners so that everyone has the opportunity to gain this knowledge in a way that is consistent with what they need to grow. And if you have a very rigid professor, very conservative professor, very unmoving professor, then that can really inhibit that process of having diverse learners in the class.
So Jack, should a good education then challenge a student's beliefs and perhaps even make that student uncomfortable? You talked about your student who knew a lot of things and had great recall, et cetera. Were his beliefs challenged or were they cemented in his thoughts?
Well, first of all, of course, it's important to remember that professors are not partisans or advocates, right? So my job isn't to persuade my students to believe what I believe, right? I tell them now, in the language of the young people, I always tell them they're NPCs, non-player characters, right? They're just not that important to me. I would not, you know, for me to force my students to believe in my political beliefs, it would be unprofessional. Yeah. It would put my job at a risk.
And they're I'm not really suggesting yeah. that.
No, I know. Yeah. I just wanted to establish that in the beginning. Now, with that said, what we want in certain fields is for students to understand why they think what they think. And that may involve changing their minds and that may involve supporting them. But it really depends on the discipline. Because yes, in philosophy, I am going to challenge everyone's beliefs. I'm going to undermine their certainty. I'm going to make them defend themselves. I'm going to have them argue with one another. And I'm not going to tell them what's right or what's not. In engineering, they're going to tell you what the, you know, strength of a certain
we don't want the bridge to collapse.
Right. You don't want the bridge of steel to collapse. But a good engineering professor is going to say to you, okay, you're the head engineer in a project. You have $100 million. You do the safety study and you find out that the bridge isn't really safe. And if you want it to be safe, you need an extra $50 million and an extra 6 months. But you say that and you might get fired. What do you do? Right? So there are tons of things in engineering that are definitive and clear. There are then steps that you need to be critical to how to apply them. Is this, you know, what do I know about engineering, right? But is this a river that's wide enough that you can use a suspension bridge? Is this, you know, rough enough that you need pillars, right? Those sorts of things. Is the bridge supposed to sway or not? All these, those are judgment questions. But then there are deeper philosophical philosophy of engineering questions that are often, among other things, ethical questions, which is what's more important, keeping your job or the safety of strangers, saving money and having a higher risk or spending money and having a lower risk, or even how important is it for the bridge to be beautiful? Is it worth spending an extra $25 million to have something like the Brooklyn Bridge, which is a tremendously beautiful work of art, as opposed to some other bridge, you know, one of the Seattle bridges, which looks like, you know, a floating sidewalk? Lots of disciplines have definitive knowledge that requires people to memorize, to be able to recall, and to make judgments about the clearly right or clearly wrong answer. But other disciplines don't focus on right or wrong, but focus on the process of thinking and the process of challenging. And this is actually one of the reasons why the sort of the complaint that professors are all liberal is so nonsensical. Because yes, maybe the professors in the English department or the sociology department are liberal. Maybe that's the case. Maybe. but the engineering professors are not liberal. The business professors are not liberal. The nursing professors are not liberal in many ways, right? In many ways they are, because there's a right and a wrong. And if you do it wrong, you kill people. And so education is going to have all of those aspects. And you can never paint all education within a single brushstroke. You have to recognize that every discipline, every subject area has its own standards of good and bad thinking, of right and wrong, of truth and falsity. Just another example. If you are teaching someone football and you get them to throw the football within 2 inches of the receiver's hands, that's fine. If you are building a bridge and the bridge is 2 inches short, that is not fine at all. So even standards of measurement, of exactness, of precision, very radical.
We're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota in just a moment. This is our monthly Philosophical Currents segment, and we are talking about education. What does it actually mean to be educated? More after this news. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, continuing our Philosophical Currents discussion with University of North Dakota's philosophy professor, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He hosts each month Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And by the way, Jack, congratulations on a major milestone that you just had recently with that show, celebrating your 200th episode. Kudos to you.
Thank you so much. It's very exciting. And of course, Prairie Public did a wonderful special on it with a lovely interview with me and my wife, Kim, who was wonderful, and some very generous things said at the end by listeners and supporters. And it made me feel really appreciative and appreciated. And just being a part of Prairie Public for this long has been a tremendous gift. So
I can attest that we all are grateful, Jack, for your presence and your comments and your conversation with us. And I am certainly very, very pleased that we get a visit once a month here on Philosophical Currents. So thanks for that. Let's continue on, Jack. Much of public discussion about education focuses on preparing students for employment. Perhaps is preparing someone for a career the same as preparing that person for life?
Anyone who says education has no relationship to employment just isn't being polemical, is being silly. Because of course, we all need jobs, we all need to pay our bills, we all need to make good judgments. We also all need to be good citizens. And so what it means to be educated as a voter, as a member of a democracy, is going to be different than what it means to be a member of a marketing team or a pilot in an airline, right? So we have to balance those things. Now, traditionally, there has been a distinction between education and training. There's German roots to that. But the idea behind it is that education is sort of holistic and critical thinking minded, and training is vocational and about skills. And one way to understand that is a very lovely thing that a colleague very early in my career said to me that has stuck with me, which is education is what's left when they've forgotten everything you've told them. Right. And so I teach these classes and they read Plato and they read Hobbes and they read Rousseau or whatever. And I don't expect them to remember who's who 6 months down the line. I want them to get the big ideas. Now, the problem with that distinction is that it suggests that training doesn't use all of the same critical faculties as education. That it doesn't require incredible, advanced, complex thinking to do jobs that we think are mundane and what we often call unskilled labor. So years ago, I had an episode called the intellect of everyday work, the intelligence in everyday work. One of the things we talked about was the fact that to be a short order cook or to be a server takes incredible judgment and wisdom. It takes incredible training to know how to cook things so that they are cooked well, are presented at the right time so people get their meals at the same time, how to balance fast cooking things with slow cooking things. Servers have to have what my manager when I worked in a bar called restaurant eyes. They need to be able to see everything that's going on at all times, right? And of course, everything we do requires advanced judgment and intelligence, even just interacting with customers who sometimes you need to give them the benefit of the doubt. You need to understand the ambiguous things they're saying. You need to de-escalate if they get upset. So the distinction between education and training is useful because it helps us understand that some forms of education is about cultivating our humanity, is about being holistic, is about being good people, being wise citizens, having a sense of the beauty of the world. Why is the Mona Lisa worth looking at? Why is the Grand Canyon worth preserving? But, and training helps emphasize that there are skills and there's specialized knowledge that is incredibly valuable for tasks that you need a lifetime of learning, including things like plumbing and electrical work and building cars and flying a plane and things like that. So it's a very useful distinction in that sense, but it's a very dangerous distinction because what it also does is put in our mind the false notion that poor working class people are less educated or less intelligent than the elite college-aged, you know, wealthy people who go to college. And I don't mean that there aren't dumb or smart people in everything. And I also don't mean that college is unimportant. What I mean is we value certain kinds of work in certain ways and devalue others. And when people are doing the kind of jobs that a garbage collector, we dismiss that not just as unimportant, but as unskilled, in part because the people are poor, in part because people don't have to dress up in a suit and tie, right? My father-in-law, who passed away a few years ago, wonderful guy, he was of this generation that it was not work if you were not wearing a suit and a tie, right? You no matter what you did, if you know, you go to the office, you wore a suit and tie. And there are plenty of people who don't do that. That work is not less difficult. That work is not less skilled or less specialized. And as we saw during the pandemic, the work that we dismiss was the work that was considered the essential jobs with essential workers, right? The garbage man, the short order cooks, the delivery people, they were the essential workers. And, you know, the philosophy professors were a little less important for a while. So the best way to manage your question, which is, you know, is education for employment, is to say education is for everything in the human experience from birth to death, because everything requires some kind of skills and intellectual development. And here's just a simple example. If I was to stand on a boat looking at the horizon with a sailor, the sailor who has the same vision as me, well, he doesn't, I have terrible vision, but besides, the sailor who's seeing the same thing as me is going to quote unquote see a zillion pieces of information that helps them navigate, anticipate weather, manage the boat, etc. And I'm going to say, ooh, water, sky, pretty, right?
Pretty sunset. You
know? Right. And because just the act of seeing requires development over time, because there are specialized seers, just as there are specialized hearers or speakers or tasters or what have you. And so we have to recognize not just that education is for all of these purposes, but that education is completely intertwined. So you can't really distinguish except analytically when you're trying to investigate it for some, let's say, academic reason.
So to drill down just a little bit more about this, how should schools then balance practical skills with subjects such as philosophy or history or literature, music and art, whose value may be harder to measure?
The best way, I think, is probably the least efficient way. and that's one of the problems with bureaucracy. The reason why we have grades 1, 2, 3, 4, the reasons why we have English class and math class and social studies is that you get specialized people who can then have a common curriculum, right? So that we know that the kid in Tennessee is learning basically the same thing and the same methodology as the kid in Michigan. But that has led to a myth that there's a first grade reading level, a second grade reading level, a third grade reading levels. Those don't exist. Also because some children can be on the, we'll stick with those numbers, can read like a sixth grader, but do math like a first grader, or do art like a third grader and understand social studies like a 12th grader. And so the best way to teach this is not to have a first grade, a second grade, a third grade, a fourth grade dividing up into the subjects. The first is to say, where are you in each area of knowledge, and where in the line of classes can you fit in? But second, we have to ideally combine the ideas to show that they're all interrelated. So one of my favorite all-time books, philosophy books, and this is very against my personality type, one of my favorite all-time books is this book called The Foundations of Arithmetic by Gottlob Frege. It's the late 19th, early 20th century. And he asks the question, what is a number? What is the number one? And the book that was followed up by that, a book called Principles of Mathematics, Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead wrote this book trying to prove that 1 + 1 = 2. And my copy has 3 thick volumes, right? Well, actually, what they're trying to prove is that math is really logic at root. But in order to do that, they have to prove that 1 + 1 = 2. So now you have a little kid, and you're teaching them the times tables. And you stop and you ask, is the number 9 real? What does that mean? Is there a big 9 floating around? Is 9 just 9 objects? If I take 9 pieces of candy, is there a 9-ness separate from that candy? Or is it just a number that we identify how many of us certain things are? Kids love stuff like that. Very, very brief story. Or would be the first one, but very, very brief story. I used to work with an organization called Philosophy for Children that would train teachers to train to do philosophy in K through 12. And my favorite curriculum is a book called The Doll Hospital for preschool kids, doing philosophy with preschool kids. And you'd read them a story and you'd talk about the story. And the story is this kid had a doll. We learn all about their relationship. The kid is riding the doll on his bicycle, and the doll falls and crashes and cracks his head. The doll's head breaks. So it might've been she, I can't remember. He or she went with their mom to the store, the doll hospital. And they wanted to fix the head, and the guy at the doll hospital said, okay, pulls out his catalog, finds all of the doll heads and says, come back in a week, it'll be fixed. And they replace the doll's head. And in the last chapters of the book, this 5-year-old kid had to decide whether it was the same doll or not, right? The doll that you loved had a different head. And heads are where the self is for us, right? Eyes, brain, you know, it's a different head. Doesn't mean it's a different doll. And in the end, the kid decided it was a different doll and never played with it again. Mm. Now, that is an incredibly deep, sophisticated, emotionally engrossing, intimate conversation. But you can have it with 5-year-olds and you can have it with 6-year-olds. But what you need is a teacher who has breadth enough of knowledge and sophistication enough in the interconnectedness of information and life that they can integrate all of these things. And the problem is that doesn't work bureaucratically for a public school system that has to educate, I don't know, 40 million children a year. Because what you have to do is say, okay, we're not going to have 30 children classes. We're going to have 10 children classes. And we're not going to have 20 teachers at our school that we're paying $30,000 a year. We're going to have 50 teachers in our school that we're paying $100,000 a year. And we have chosen to have a very narrow, efficient, bureaucratic, artificial notion of what it means to know things because we don't want to spend the money to have a mass education system that genuinely educates in a holistic way. And so what you get in the United States, if you know European teenagers, like a junior in high school, Italy, Germany, Spain, France, they know so much more than American students because their education system is very different. There are real problems with their education system, but aside from that. So the reason why we have general education requirements at universities is because we have to teach the students all the things that they should have learned in high school in the beginning of university. Now, something very problematic happened under President Obama. His education secretary made a rule that said you can't get federal funding unless you have a declared major, right? This seems like a minor thing, right? You need to declare a major in order to get a student loan. But here's the problem. Up until that point, college students didn't declare majors until their second semester, sophomore years, usually. So they took all these general education requirements and they learned all this different stuff and they decided by their second year what they wanted to do. And then the second half of their college was following their major, being specialized, built on all of these skills that they had, and successfully completing the school. The idea behind this change was students would get through school quicker. But now here's what happens. Students declare before they start school what their major is based on having no life experience. Mm-hmm. They then get sucked into their majors, doing advanced courses right away. And so I get a lot of students who take Intro to Philosophy their senior year, their last class. And so they're taking the classes where they learned how to write and read after they're taking the classes when they're doing specialized knowledge. So they do worse in their classes and they discover very often after 3 semesters that they actually hate their major. They're burnt out and they want to start over, but none of those major classes count. So they're back at scratch, and now it's not taking them 4 years to complete. It's taking them 5 and 6 years to complete. So we've done 2 really problematic things. The first is we've teach them specialized knowledge without teaching them basic skills, which makes them fail and get frustrated and not appreciate and learn and enjoy it. And we've set them up to have to restart, spend more money, spend more time, be more exhausted and more resentful, and all while claiming to make it more efficient and better. And therefore, all we can do to keep the students is to make it easier and give them better grades, because they're not getting the grades they want their first, second semester, because they're in, you know, they're in, I don't know, English 350 or let's say, you know, I don't know, whatever, they're in a 300 level course when they should be taking all 100 level courses. And our sense of how education is intertwined is completely messed up, because it ignores the fact that vocational training has to be, this goes back to one of your earlier questions, has to be built on a foundation of general knowledge and basic skills. And if you do that backwards, all that happens is students think that education is just about getting a degree, because they're not really learning anything.
Jack, as we wind our conversation down today, after those 4 years or 5 years, if it was a little more of a struggle, we had to change majors, what responsibilities do we carry after we've received our education? If society invests in us, in our education, what do we owe our community in return?
This is a complex question, because it has to do with both personal morals and civic virtue, right? How responsible we are to other people. But I think the bottom line is we have the obligation to remain current in whatever new knowledge there is in what we do.
Remain students.
And remain students for life and do the best job we can, because when we do our jobs badly, we hurt other people. And that ranges from, you know, giving people vaccinations to setting up the lights at a concert. Everything we do affects everyone else, and everything everyone else does affects us in some way. And so to think of ourselves as educated and a completely free agent is to misunderstand that all individual knowledge is intertwined with collective knowledge, and collective knowledge only advances when individual knowledge is taken seriously. And so we have a responsibility to be lifelong learners and lifelong workers of integrity and citizens of integrity, neighbors of integrity, parents of integrity.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein joins me monthly for Philosophical Currents. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota, and he also hosts Why Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life on the second Sunday of each month, right here on Prairie Public at 5 p.m. Central Time. Jack, it's always a pleasure. Best wishes as you embark on a new school year at the University of North Dakota.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone comes through my classroom of every age. You're all welcome. And reach out if I can be of help. And thank you, Craig, as always. It's been wonderful and challenging. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pets.